Good afternoon, and welcome to our session on longevity risk. I'm Anthony Asher. I have no position at the Institute. I'm a convener of the Retirement Incomes Working Group, but it's not entirely relevant here, or only partly so. Today, though, our speaker is Jackie Lee. Dr. Jackie Lee, with a PhD from Melbourne and Macquarie. Having worked for general insurers and super funds, I don't know where he fitted all this activity in, and has been at Macquarie since 2015, if we take that. So he's worked on general insurance risk reserving and on longevity issues, and as he no doubt will tell you today, this is the result of a project that has been sponsored by the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries and the LLMA, the industry body on longevity risk. So Jackie, without further ado, over to you.
Thanks. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here giving a presentation. Today I will talk about the major results of our recent research projects, mainly on the topic of measuring basis risk for longevity transactions. Before I start, on behalf of our research team, I would like to thank the Actuaries Institute for organizing this talk and thank Anthony for chairing today. The first one of our project is assessing basis risk for longevity transactions, phase two. It has been co-funded by the IFOA and LLMA in UK and supervised by the Longevity Basis Risk Working Group with members from both the IFOA and LLMA. Phase one of the project was completed by Cass Business School and Hyman Robertson LLP back in 2014, in which a decision tree framework was developed as a practical guide on how to select a two population mortality projection model. What have I done? Phase two, focusing on measuring longevity basis risk in realistic scenarios under practical circumstances, was completed by Macquarie University last year with a support from Mercer. The final reports can be downloaded from this IFOA website. The research team members include myself, my colleagues, Professor Leonie Tickle and Dr. Chong-Yip Tan, and also Professor Johnny Lee, an expert in longevity risk from University of Waterloo. The second project can be seen as a follow-up project. It further investigates the impact of model uncertainty on index-based longevity hedging and covers some other different models in addition to the initial modeling framework set in the phase one of the IFOA project. This research has been sponsored by the Insurance Risk and Finance Research Center at Nanyang Business School in Singapore and Global Reinsurer SCORE, who also provide feedback on the project. More information can be found in this website. The research team members include Prof. Udiva Balazoria from Nanyang Business School, myself, and Prof. Johnny Lee from Waterloo. Besides these two funded projects, I will also cover briefly some other related research results today. May I first take a few minutes to talk about the background of this research. It is a well-known global phenomenon that mortality continues to decline. Different studies have shown that improved nutrition, hygiene, medical technology, healthcare, lifestyle are the major contributing factors to increasing longevity. Accordingly, financial institutions and governments encounter the so-called longevity risk, the risk that pension funds or annuity portfolios may pay out more than expected due to unanticipated mortality improvements. In particular, while non-systematic longevity risk can be diversified by having more fund members or selling more policies, systematic longevity risk cannot simply be diversified by pooling, as the effects of better knowledge and better technology affects everyone. In general, insurance companies and governments are cautious about taking too much longevity risk. Broadly speaking, there are three ways to manage longevity risk. The first is traditional reinsurance, in which an insurer can pass the unwanted risk to a reinsurer by paying a premium. However, reinsurers often have limited appetite for longevity risk. The second is natural hedging, which makes use of the opposite movements between the values of annuities and life insurances. In principle, it would work as one goes up and the other naturally goes down. But in practice, it is feasible only for certain very large insurers who have the resources and scale to sell both kinds of policies. There are also some technical issues which I will cover later in the presentation. The third is capital market solutions, which is under much attention in the last decade, particularly in the UK and some European countries. These include insurance securitization, which means securitizing a class of business as a complex bundle into highly structured securities, and longevity or mortality-linked derivatives, which have their payoffs linked to the mortality experience of a certain population. From market investors' perspective, these securities may provide an opportunity to diversify across a market sector that is arguably uncorrelated with traditional asset classes, or to gain risk-adjusted returns in exchange for taking on longevity risk. Back in 2010, the LLMA was founded in the UK by several global insurers, investment banks. The purpose is to promote the development of a life market, a liquid life market, in which longevity and mortality-linked securities and liabilities can readily be traded amongst insurers, reinsurers, and market investors. Despite the various efforts by different parties, the life market is still in its infancy stage and is far from reaching the full potential in providing diversification opportunities and enhancing market efficiency. This figure shows that the UK life market has grown in size significantly over the last few years. From 2011 to 2015, the average annual volume of pension buy-ins, buyouts, and longevity swaps has reached more than £18 billion. But this size is only 1.5% of the total private sector defined benefit pension assets, which is estimated to be around £1.2 trillion. It is clear that there is still plenty of room for the life market to develop further in the future. Besides the UK, a few other countries like Ireland, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Canada, and the US have also seen some growth in recent years. These de-risking solutions, pension buy-ins, buyouts, longevity swaps, are currently dominant in the UK life market. They are basically bespoke transactions, which are tailored specifically to individual circumstances. However, the main providers of these solutions are still within the insurance industry, which means that as a whole, there is a limit of how much longevity risk can be absorbed. By contrast, index-based solutions are constructed such that their cash flows are linked to selected mortality indices. For example, in our country, it could be the number of survivors of the cohort aged 65 in 2018 living in New South Wales. Anyone here belonging to this group? We can have an index for you. Okay. These standardized products based on well-specified mortality indices could potentially draw more investors' interest from both inside and outside the insurance world because they are supposed to be more transparent, relatively easier to understand and more liquid, as the market liquidity can be increased by having more and more participants over time. One notable example is the 12 billion euro longevity swap offered by Deutsche Bank to Dutch insurer Aegon about 6 years ago, in which the Dutch population was taken as an index and the entire trade was targeted to the wide capital market. Index-based longevity hedges have considerable potential to offer effective risk management and capital management. Some proposed tools include longevity bond, Q-forward, longevity swap, and mortality option. Yep, they are a combination of the terms we are familiar with and some finance terms. Options, bonds with mortality, longevity, which are linked to the mortality experience of a reference population. In spite of its huge potential, index-based solutions have been losing ground to bespoke transactions in the last decade. There are both economic and technical reasons behind this. As we know, the global economic conditions haven't been really that great for quite some time since the 2008 financial crisis. But our focus here is on the technical reasons. By nature, there is a mismatch between the reference population of index-based derivatives and the portfolio to be hedged, the underlying population of which is referred to as the book population. Because of this mismatch between the reference and the book populations, longevity basis risk would arise, which include demographic basis risk, sampling basis risk, and structural basis risk, which I will explain in the next few slides. It is generally perceived that the difficulty in quantifying this basis risk is one major obstacle in more widespread use of index-based solutions. Consider a pension plan with a certain amount of longevity risk. We call the population underlying the plan the book population. Suppose the pension plan sponsor wants to reduce longevity risk exposure by using a hedging instrument. And this instrument is linked to a particular index population or reference population, such as Australian population of a specific cohort. This index-based approach, however, would not give a perfect hedge. Firstly, the book population and the reference population, though demographically related, are different after all, and may have different mortality trends. This leads to demographic basis risk. Secondly, the number of lives in the pension plan is usually smaller, much smaller than that in the whole population. The randomness of individual lives could drive the two experiences apart, and this is sampling basis risk. Finally, the plan pays regularly on the survival of the pensioners, while the hedging instrument pays according to its specific design, and the two streams of payments are usually different in their amounts and also timing, which give rise to structural basis risk. So we have to find a way to measure the extent of mismatching the basis risk between the two sides, and then work out the actual amount of longevity risk that can be reduced. From a modeling point of view or a regulatory perspective such as Solvency II, demographic basis risk can further be divided into process error, parameter error, and model error. Or many call them process risk, parameter uncertainty, and model uncertainty. Process error refers to the variability in the time series. Parameter error arises from the uncertainty in estimating the model parameters, and model error reflects the uncertainty in model selection. There are probably more than 30 multi-population mortality projection models being proposed in literature, and they can roughly be categorized into a few families of models, including Lee-Carter, Lee and Lee, and CBD. All these models produce certain time-varying parameters. Modeling the time series of the time-varying parameters allow for process error, in which different time series processes could have different effects. To incorporate parameter error as well, bootstrapping approaches such as residuals bootstrapping and semi-parametric bootstrapping are required, as the process involves generating some pseudo past data and refitting the model to these pseudo data. While most of the studies cover only process error or both process error and parameter error, relatively little attention has been given to assessing model error. Model error can be studied by simply comparing the results from a range of different models, or we propose a modified bootstrapping approach to allow a reselection of model for each pseudo data in the process, and so it further allows for model error. Here is a review of some of the models. I know some of you may have just survived the Monday blues, and mathematical formulae are probably not the most interesting thing you would like to see in such a lovely lunch break. So I will go through it quickly. CAE plus cohorts model, an extension of the Lee-Carter model. The first model component is for the reference population with the superscript R. Q represents the reference mortality rate at age X in year T. As shown in the graph, the whole mortality curve drops over time, which reflects the ongoing mortality improvement of the reference population. On the right-hand side of the equation, it is a Lee-Carter kind of structure. Alpha X refers to the mortality schedule over age. Beta X is an age-specific sensitivity measure. And kappa T is so-called the mortality index, which indicates the overall mortality improvement over time. This kappa T is modeled by a random walk with drift. At the end, there is also the cohort parameter, which is modeled by an ARIMA 110. In the second component, Q is the book mortality rate with the superscript B. The difference between the logit book rate and the logit reference rate is expressed in terms of an other Lee-Carter structure with a different alpha x, but the same beta x as above, and that is why it is called common age effect, CAE, and a different kappa, which is modeled by an AR1 process. Note that these graphs are obtained from fitting the model to one of our particular data sets. The next one, Lee-Lee model, is actually a multi-population extension of the Lee-Carter model. The first equation is for the reference population. M represents the reference central death rate at age X in year T. On the right, alpha X refers to the mortality schedule over age. The second term is a common factor for both populations, with beta X being the age-specific sensitivity measure, and kappa T being the common mortality index, with the superscript C representing is common between the two populations. This common kappa T is modeled by a random walk with drift. The third term contains specific additional factors for the reference population itself, in which there is another beta X, and the time-varying parameter kappa T is modeled by an AR1 process. That is again the cohort parameter, which is modeled by an ARIMA 110. The second equation is for the book population with its own alpha X. The same common factor and the same common mortality index and the specific additional factors for the book population, in which the time-varying parameter kappa T is modeled by an AR1. The cohort parameter is modeled by an ARIMA 110 process. Note that this model Under this model expression, there are two cohort parameters for the two populations. While there's only one cohort parameter in the previous model, whether to use one cohort parameter or two depends on the data being modeled. The last one, finally, M7-M5 model, is an extension of the CBD model. In the first component, on the left, it is the logit-Q again. On the right, kappa 1 refers to the level of the mortality curve. And obviously, it decreases over time. Kappa 2 refers to the slope of the mortality curve. And you can see that it increases over time, which means the mortality curve gets steeper across time. Kappa 3 refers to the curvature of the mortality curve. Its increasing trend means that the mortality curve gets more bent over time. These three kappas are modeled by a trivariate random walk with drift. The last parameter, gamma, allows for the cohort effect, and it is modeled by an ARIMA 110 process. In the second model component, the difference between the logit book rate and the logit reference rate is expressed as another two kappas, 1 and 2. And they are modeled by an VAR1 process. All these time series processes mentioned above, like random walk, ARIMA, AR, VAR, are from the originally proposed versions. And on top of that, we have also tested a wide range of other choices for comparison. Another option is the characterization approach. When the data size is small, you can see it's very small, right? Modeling the data directly may overestimate the basis risk. So, under this approach, we don't do that. Instead, we further divide the data into a few categories. For example, high income, medium income, low income, and then find some other data which have a large size for modeling. Now they look much bigger, isn't it? And use these bigger data as a proxy for each category. Finally, the models are fitted to these proxy bigger data, and their simulations are aggregated together and are treated as if they were simulated from the original small book data. This graph provides a summary of all the risk components. Besides demographic basis risk, sampling basis risk can be incorporated by using a binomial distribution to simulate the number of future survivors. Regarding structural basis risk, numerical optimization techniques or approximation methods like mortality duration matching, a concept similar to bond duration matching, mortality duration. We also have mortality convexity. So new things have been proposed in the literature recently. So we can use this mortality duration matching to use it to calibrate the hedge and calculate the required weights of the hedging instruments. Our data are provided by the Continuous Mortality Investigation, CMI, the Office for National Statistics in the UK, Mercer, Australia, and the Human Mortality Database. The first three data sets are taken as the book experience, as they can be used to represent the mortality experience of a specific group of lives, like a pension plan or an annuity portfolio. The last data set is taken as the reference population, as the mortality experience of a whole country is usually adopted as an index. We start with a simple hypothetical example of a pension plan or an annuity portfolio. Suppose all the lives are aged 65 now. Each pension or annuity pays $1 per year on survival from ages 66 to 90. That means 25 years. The pension plan is closed, or the annuity portfolio is in runoff. A 25-year index-based longevity swap for the same cohort is used to hedge the position. The size of the swap is calculated from numerical optimization based on the simulated scenarios. The objective of the optimization is to minimize the longevity risk of the liability. Assume that the interest rate is 1% per annum. Then later on in the sensitivity analysis, we examine a variety of changes to these simple settings. For example, different portfolio sizes, multiple cohorts, using older ages, open pension plan, several swaps for multiple cohorts, different interest rates, different data fitting periods, alternative simulation methods, additional features like mortality jumps, and structural changes. So we have tested a variety of things and also different time series processes. Here we will only go through the major implications, and you can find all the details in the report. We focus on the use of index-based longevity swaps. In current practice, bespoke longevity swaps are by far the most commonly used hedging instruments in the UK. So how does an index-based swap work? Consider a pension fund which pays pensions to the pensioners, and these payments depend on the book experience. At the same time, if the funds enter into an index-based swap with a certain counterparty and make fixed regular payments, in return, the fund receives floating payments from the counterparty, and these payments depend on the reference population. Clearly, the two sets of cash flows would not be perfectly matched due to demographic basis risk, sampling basis risk, and structural basis risk, as mentioned earlier. It is important to calibrate the swaps carefully in terms of the age buckets used, the maturities, and the weights, and also to estimate the amount of longevity risk that can be reduced by using the swaps. Regarding demographic basis risk, here are some simulated examples of how the book rates and the reference rates may move together or deviate from each other over time. We use the CMI data, the HMD data, and the CAE plus cohorts model, and a single cohort aged 65 in 2014 for this demonstration. In the first graphs, the black lines are for the book populations, and the gray lines are for the reference population. The book mortality is lower than the reference mortality, and of course, the mortality rates increase with age. Moreover, the solid lines refer to the best estimates, and the dashed lines refer to the simulated values. You can see that in this simulated scenario, the two populations' future mortality rates follow the expected values closely and move in parallel amongst each other. Everything seems to go according to the plan, and there's not much drama here. In the second scenario, both populations' future mortality rates deviate from their expected values over time. But since they still go hand in hand with each other, there's still not much mismatching problem here. But in the third scenario, while the reference mortality rates stick closely to the expected values, the book rates diverge from the expected trend and deviate significantly from the reference mortality rates in the later period, being much lower than what it is supposed to be. This is the mismatching problem we would worry about. This is the basis risk. There are certainly many other possible scenarios you can simulate, but they would fall broadly into these three categories. The question is, the last one is basis risk. What is the probability for each scenario to occur? We need one of those two population mortality projection models to measure this basis risk. Using an appropriate model which allows for longevity basis risk, we can measure the effectiveness of an index-based longevity hedge. Here, we show the simulated distributions of the pension liability using the CMI, ONS, and Mercer datasets before and after taking the hedge. It is very clear that the hedge significantly reduces the variability of the pension liability. In particular, the right tail is very much reduced, which may be of much concern in practice and may indicate certain opportunities for capital savings. To quantify the precise level of longevity risk reduction, we define it with this formula. The notation risk unhedged is the portfolio's longevity risk before taking the hedge. Risk hedged is the risk afterwards, before and after. In effect, this metric gives the percentage of the portfolio's initial longevity risk that is being hedged away. Regarding the risk measures, how to define risk, we consider the common ones, including the variance, the standard deviation, value at risk, and expected shortfall. Although the variance is the one usually adopted in the basis risk literature, this risk measure has a different scale to the other three, and it always results in a much higher calculated level of risk reduction. So we focus on the other three risk measures, but not quite the variance. In addition, the value at risk is highly relevant to the solvency capital requirement under Solvency II, while the expected shortfall has recently been suggested to replace the value at risk in some banking regulations. After examining several hundreds of simulated cases from different model settings, data sets, and hedging instruments, hedging environments, in which each case had 5,000 simulated scenarios, we find that for a large pension plan or a large annuity portfolio, like having around 20,000 lives or more, the risk reduction level is often around 50% to 80%. But for a small plan or a small portfolio, the risk reduction is usually less than 50%. These results highlight the impact of sampling basis risk, under which the high variability in a small book due to individual uncertainty can significantly hamper the effectiveness of an index-based hedge. It appears that index-based longevity hedging would be more feasible for very large portfolios or large foundations joined by small plans or portfolios, or reinsurers who have accumulated a lot of exposures from smaller insurers and pension plans. But note that the precise risk reduction level really depends on the particular situation, the circumstance being studied, and more details can be found in the report. As mentioned above, we have done an extensive sensitivity analysis, and this is the list of the most important factors we have found in calculating risk reduction. First, whether the portfolio size is large, as what I've covered just now, whether the model is coherent, it means that the projected or the expected ratio of future mortality rates between the two populations at each age converges to a constant in the long term. Whether the book data is a significant subset of the reference data, is the longevity swap or other derivatives like the Q forward being used, whether bootstrapping or a simple parametric method is used, and whether structural mortality changes are incorporated into the modeling process. Moreover, as our book data cover only a short period of time, we would love to have more data, but we don't. So many sophisticated time series processes cannot really be used with such a short length of the data. But we still tested different variations of the time series modeling assumptions and studied the corresponding impact. We find that the most important factor is whether the assumed future variability of the second component, the book minus reference component in two of the three models just now, the CAE plus cohort and the M7-M5 models, whether the future variability of the second component is bounded or not. In fact, despite the obvious differences between different models, this time series assumption turns out to be the most important consideration in estimating the risk reduction. Another important factor is how fast the model would reach coherence, that is, how fast the two populations' future mortality rates would take to move back in line. Comparatively, the other correlation assumptions are not so important. Further research is required when more book data of longer periods and for different portfolios can be collected in the future. We also summarize the hedging results of our hundreds of simulated cases in a simple qualitative way and also another simple quantitative way. Two important general insurance industry reports in Australia have used these approaches in the past. Regulators and practitioners may expand on these two ideas to develop a prescribed approach to calculate the risk reduction of an index-based longevity hedge compared to a full internal modeling approach which requires the use of our models and other models. This is a simple demonstration of the qualitative approach. Imagine you are an actuary working on pensions or annuities, talking to yourself in a very boring, lonely night in your room after a whole day of hard work and many meetings. You start to ask yourself, does the plan or does the portfolio have a lot of members? If yes, you give 50 points. Remember, for a large portfolio, the risk reduction is 50% or more based on our simulations. The next question, are the two populations very related? Quite, 6 out of 10, I think. Do the two populations' future mortality rates move back in line quickly? Average, say 5 out of 10. Would there be potential structural changes that affect both populations in about the same way? Maybe. Let's give 4. When you add the scores together, it shouldn't be too hard. It's a total of 65, which means about 65% of the risk can potentially be hedged away. Of course, this is a simple demonstration, but it illustrates how you could possibly use some simple standardized factors to make a qualitative judgment on how much risk can be hedged by an index-based hedging. Here is a simple linear regression formula summarizing all our simulated results. There are 10 explanatory variables, including the log portfolio size, how related the two populations are, the design of the hedging scheme, the interest rate, using swaps or Q-forwards, whether M7-M5 is used, whether CAE plus cohort is used, which simulation method is adopted, whether structural mortality changes are incorporated, and the autoregressive order of the second component's time series process. So we put all the major factors into a simple linear regression and look at the sign of the coefficients. The first 5 variables refer to the portfolio and the hedging environment, and the others describe the model settings and assumptions. The signs of the coefficients can tell how the risk reduction would react to a change in a certain factor. The larger the size, the higher the risk reduction, and so the positive sign. The closer the relationship between the two populations, the higher the risk reduction. We use a categorical variable here to differentiate the relationships. The more approximate the hedging scheme, the lower the risk reduction, and so the negative sign. Again, we use a categorical variable. The higher the interest rate, the lower the risk reduction. Using Q forwards decreases the risk reduction. These two values indicate that the CAE plus cohort model tends to give a higher risk reduction estimate than the M7-M5. Using a simple parametric method, which does not allow for parameter uncertainty, increases the risk reduction. This highlights the importance of incorporating parameter uncertainty. Including structural changes increases the risk reduction because the two populations would move more consistently if they are both influenced significantly by the same factor. Lastly, the higher the autoregressive order, the slower the convergence of the time series process in the second component of the two models, the more the mismatching and the lower the risk reduction. So these are the major, we have tested a wide range of factors and assumptions and settings, and these are the ones that we found to be the most important and have significant effect. Besides index-based hedging, I will also talk a bit about natural hedging. It exploits the opposite movements in the values of annuities and life insurances when mortality changes. For certain large insurance companies, it may be advantageous to adjust the business composition and utilize this natural hedging effect to lower the capital requirement. Under the recent development of the life market, insurance companies can also, besides internally doing that natural hedging, insurance companies can also enter into, say, a mortality swap with an external party to construct an external hedge. For example, under this swap, an annuity provider can pay floating cash flows to a life insurer based on the actual number of deaths in the life insurer's portfolio. In return, the life insurer pays floating cash flows to the annuity provider based on the number of survivors in the annuity provider's portfolio. So they swap the two payments and create a hedge. But this swap is not structured on a standardized index. It is an over-the-counter transaction, and there is counterparty risk that one party may default. Regardless of whether it is internal or external hedge, basis risk exists because the two populations are different. So once again, a two-population mortality projection model is required to measure the hedge effectiveness. Let's look at a simple hypothetical example of a large insurer selling both an annuity and a life insurance. This example is extracted from my previous work with Professor Stephen Haberman from Carl Smith School in the UK. Suppose all annuitants are aged 65, and all lives assured are aged 35 now. Each annuity pays $1,400 per annum on the survival of the annuitant, and the sum assured of the life insurance is $100,000 on death. These amounts are set in such a way that the expected present values of the two products are approximately equal, so that the effects of different portfolio compositions can be compared. Suppose there are a total of 100,000 policies, and 101 portfolio compositions are considered, in which the weight of life policies increases by 1% each time from 0% to 100%. So at one extreme, we have 0% life policies. At the one extreme, we have all in life policies. So we want to see the effect of having different business compositions. The hedge effectiveness is then calculated based on the simulated scenarios from the Lilly model, the second model. Assume that the interest rate is 3% per annum. The first graph here shows the coefficient of variation of the total present value at each weight considered. It can be seen that the optimal product mix in terms of the lowest variability is achieved at a weight of about 45%. It means that 45% of life policies together with 55% of annuities would give rise to the lowest variability in this case. The conclusion is about the same if we look at the 95th percentile and also the 99th percentile. By using an appropriate two-population mortality projection model, longevity basis risk between the two groups can properly be allowed for, and the hedge effectiveness of a particular position can be estimated. Based on the numerous simulated cases from different model settings and assumptions, we find that for a large portfolio, the risk reduction level is usually around 40% to 70%. But for a small portfolio, the risk reduction is often less than 40%. Again, the impact of sampling basis risk is significant. Moreover, these risk reduction figures tend to be smaller than those from the earlier index-based hedging example. The main reason is that there is an additional piece of demographic basis risk here, the age difference. The age difference, because in the index-based example just now, the age are matched. But this one is age 65, one is age 35. So there's an additional mismatching here. And therefore, the risk reduction is a little bit lower. We have tested that if the ages are matched more closely, the risk reduction will increase as the resulting hedge would then be more effective. We hope that this research work will encourage a step change in the ability to assess longevity basis risk. Looking forward, it is important to further test more book data, more models, time series processes, more hedging scenarios to gain a deeper understanding of longevity basis risk and to identify opportunities for potential capital savings. It is also important to communicate the results properly with different stakeholders, insurers, the banks, the regulators, the clients, on the feasibility and the practical implementation of index-based hedging. Also, it would be worthwhile for the regulators in the industry to develop a standardized and comprehensive list of key factors that drive longevity basis risk. And practitioners can then choose between a prescribed approach, which makes a simple use of the key factors I have just shown just now, and alternatively, an internal modeling approach, which requires necessary expertise to perform the modeling and the computations. If you're interested in the latter and requires such extra advice, give us a call. There are a few more things to consider in future research. First, all these results are based on static hedging, which means the hedging tools are not rebalanced in the future. By contrast, dynamic hedging requires constant rebalancing of the hedge portfolio, and it would be interesting to explore the feasibility of dynamic index-based hedging. Second, in order not to just look at the benefits, but also the costs of constructing an index-based longevity hedge, it would be useful to investigate different market pricing methods for pricing index-based derivatives. More information can be found in the IFOA Phase 2 report. This report can be approached in three different ways. If you don't have much time, I presume you are, you can simply go through the graphs and the tables. And there are quite many of them, and you can certainly get some idea through these figures. For those who have difficulty in going to sleep at night, it's a 140-page report. So reading through the content would probably help. And finally, for those modelers and analysts who have inexplicable obsession with mathematical formulae and programming, like myself, you are encouraged to read the two appendices, which have all the technical and programming details there, very detailed. Thank you for listening to my presentation. I hope you've enjoyed it and find it informative in some way. Thank you.
Taking us through both the practical and the theoretical side and giving us some indication of the numbers. So we have a number of people on the webinar who will be hopefully sending in questions. There's a minute or two delay, but are there any comments or questions that people here would like to make?
Just if you would announce your name and Michael Berg, Rice Warner. Just to highlight a few things which could move the nature of the book population would include just, and thinking of the UK, a lot of things which could change the makeup of it. So a recent example would be change of annuitization from being compulsory to being voluntary, and before that, changes in the makeup of defined benefit funds, with them becoming voluntary instead of condition of employment in the late 80s, and then your sort of shift in employment patterns with a lot of the manufacturing being offshore, but a lot of the engineering and management work staying in the UK. How would you deal with all of those in assessing relevance of index-based hedges versus bespoke hedges?
So you are, thanks for your comments. So there are certainly some recent changes in the UK. As you mentioned, they changed it from the compulsory to voluntary. I think this is sort of about the more about the market trends. Then our focus is more on the technical side of the hedging. But there are some recently in the UK there are some more favorable conditions coming up. If I'm not wrong, for example, there seems to be more supply from the reinsurers for the capital, and therefore the life market continues to grow because of that. And because I think back in before the Solvency II, the things are not settled. And the insurers and the reinsurers in the UK are quite conservative about that. And so the development seems to be a bit stagnant. But then after the Solvency II settled down and seems that everyone just get more relaxed and chill out and they're more willing to look into the new things and look at the new products. So I think it's considering those changes, but I think now it's a good time for it to develop further. And as you can see, the growth of the transactions have grown significantly over the years, and the perception that it would continue to grow. But the major concern is still that, as I mentioned just now, the bespoke transactions still dominant over the index-based. No matter the conditions change, the regulations change, the index-based still lag behind the bespoke because people don't understand what it means. I mean, if you look at the formula just now, you feel curious and a bit hesitating, right? So that's why IFOA and LLMA want us to do some research and try to share, disseminate the knowledge that make people feel comfortable with modeling the basis risk. Yes.
I've got a conceptual question. Please correct me if my thinking is wrong. I just want to compare the three: reinsurance, natural hedging, and capital markets. The return on capital required by capital markets would be higher than reinsurance, so my annuity product offering would be uncompetitive. Also in natural hedging, if I'm competing with other life insurers who are not offering annuities, then they will start reducing their prices. If mortality improves, then again, my offering will start becoming uncompetitive. So then reinsurance is the only possible way for me to have both my life insurance offering and my annuity offering as being competitive in the market.
Can you repeat your question? So your it's a GI question, right? So I'm not.
It's a life insurance question.
Okay.
Shubham, you're saying that you think that the rate on the capital market requires a higher return than the reinsurance. That's the issue.
That's the question. Yeah.
Is that true?
Well, I'm not certain about that.
What sort of premium have the capital markets required for taking on longevity risk?
Right now it really varies because it's bespoke transactions and many of them are not really disclosed. So this is something interesting we would like to know. We know what transactions have been carried out, but these are rather private information that I don't see any. But there are few transactions that have been released and they have a price for that, but it's not a lot of information on that, so I'm not certain.
Sorry, you have an answer?
Oh no, another question.
Sorry, can you just hold it then? Does anyone have an answer, Duncan?
Matthew? Michael?
Yeah, I understand that the capital market transactions have been offering returns of in the order of 10 to 12% a year on capital put up, which would largely be in the form of collateral against the swaps.
So that's not vastly different from the return of returns required by reinsurers?
Yeah.
So there you go. It's got to be competitive.
Is there actually an issue if bespoke transactions are more dominant in the market? Is that a problem? Do we, if that, those bespoke transactions offer 100% hedging because a defined benefit scheme can completely 100% hedge their risk compared to a...
Yeah, it is a good thing as long as the demand meets, the supply meets the demand. But the thing is, the idea is it has only so much sole capital within the insurance industry. And I mean, the potential demand far exceeds what the insurance industry can take. So that is why they are trying to see into the future, sometime in the future, they need index-based hedging to have extra capital on top of the biz. But right now it works okay because I think the process just starts to develop. The life market is only a decade. And the popular ones, as I said, include buy-ins and buyouts and longevity swaps, and those are bespoke transactions and they are fine. But if you but as I said, it's only the transaction volume is only 1.5% of the potential total exposure. It's only 1.5%. And even if more insurance companies, reinsurers particularly, provide the bespoke solutions, it still won't match the potential huge demand that's going to come up as we are living longer. So I think that's why they really want to, right now it's okay, but I think they want to promote this market so we can get more capital from outside the insurance world. But at the moment, except the very notable example of the Deutsche Bank to the Dutch insurer Aegon back in 2012, that was a successful case. But after that, it seems that there's not much going on. So, and that's why they come up with this project. They hope to solve the problem and promote the development.
Any other questions? Jackie, in the Australian situation where there's virtually no existing books, isn't the real risk in the short run going to be, apart from the guys that have existing books, the major issue is the selection risk? You actually have no idea what your book population is going to look like?
Yeah, we don't. We have very little book experience in Australia, yes.
So until that develops in a way,
yeah. Right now, most people look at the UK experience because they have, but even UK doesn't have a lot of, really. I mean, I've done the research. They have given me a lot of data, but I still don't think it's a lot. It's
yeah.
But that's the best we can get. But if you talk about Australia, yeah, it's very little.
The other question I wanted to ask you: you had the CMI data. Were you using the CMI all? Sort of combined data, or were you actually looking at separate funds inside the CMI?
I look at separate industries.
Separate industries.
Industries. I could have broken it down further, but it's too small to do any meaningful modeling.
Right. So even within an industry, you don't find any company, any pension funds with more than 20,000 members.
Not to that level because it's private, it's confidential. But I could further divide it into like different pension amounts,
right?
Different genders, but once you go a bit too far, the size is so small that you can't really do anything about it. Right. So I think the optimal size for modeling, based on our team's experience, is to have by industry. But there's not much difference between different industries, by the way,
right?
Except one or two, they are quite similar. Awesome. The hedging results.
Well, finance people live forever.
Yeah, finance people. they seem to have, I can't remember, they seem to have lower mortality.
I'm sure they do. Any other comments or questions?
Paul. Towards the beginning of your presentation, you talked about a number of factors that would affect longevity, nutrition, and socioeconomic status, and so on and so forth. Have you done any research on how to parameterize that, and maybe particularly how that plays into different causes of death? I'm kind of driving at, you're talking as if increasing longevity is almost inevitable, but there has been talk that this generation is going to outlive the next generation because of greater sedentary activity, greater obesity. Have you done any research into that kind of aspect on longevity, and whether you have or not, do you think longevity will go backwards again?
Yeah, the strong trend of increasing longevity is very clear, and yes, I agree that recently there are people suggesting would that actually go back because of obesity, some long-term illness. I read a lot of papers on that, but I'm not a big fan of that because things happen for specific groups of lives. For example, recently I saw a paper by some professors in probably Stanford that they studied there's a specific group in U.S. From about 40, around 40 something years old, they actually have increasing mortality. So you always have these outliers. I don't know whether this is the right word. I mean exceptions to the general trend. But so it's difficult to comment on specific groups which are subject to very specific living factors. But as a whole, it's increasing. I mean, the longevity is increasing so strong that if we simply do an extrapolation, that you can't really see there's a slowdown at all ages for most countries. But I think it is rational to think for the very, very developed country, it may slow down a bit. But even if you look at the leader, Japan, it's not slowing down. It still increases. So if Japan, the leader, is still increasing, the others would have much room to increase too. So I think we have done a lot of work, not the causes of factors, but we've done a lot of extrapolation, underlying the underlying patterns of different age groups. The feeling is that I think for the next, no guarantee, but for the next few, maybe one or two or three decades, it's going to increase, generally speaking. But for particular groups, it may or may not go back. But for the next two, three decades, I think it will continue to grow, unless there are drastic situations like wars, epidemics. But in terms of the growth, it will be gradually going up. I can't see the stop of that trend yet. Yeah. Yes.
What?
And the idea that it's putting forward in markets other than Australia where there is actually an annuity market. So in Australia, I see the issue is actually we're trying to get a market going. But how is it perceived or received by countries where, there is an actual proper market going?
You mean in the UK?
Yeah, for example.
Well, obviously UK has the largest annuity market there, and that's why they're willing to put a lot of money here to do the research and do the project. And I think their market, just now one of the guests also mentioned they have changed the regulation and becomes voluntary. But whatever the changes are, I mean, the market is very big there. So their concern is not to start the market. Their concern is already more about how to hedge the risk. So they already are ahead of most of the... This one, yeah, we've just done it. We hope so. I think people are using the simpler versions of this. Like, my understanding is practitioners in US and UK are already, some of them are using the Lee Carter model, the very, very basic model, not this one. But now we are proposing to extend those original model is only for one population. But then we are proposing this index-based hedging, and we need a two-population model. So we extend the model a little bit, and hopefully that will do the job. So I think we are still promoting this. This is still very new. Yeah.
I just had one other question. Your parameters of the graphs are very irregular. Are you double counting some of the volatility, so do you not smooth them out in some way?
Well, you can certainly put smoothing into the modeling process. We didn't. We just used whatever that is estimated from the process. But there are papers, you know, smoothing the parameters, put the smoothing, a penalty function into the modeling and do the smoothing. That's okay. But the fitting would be poorer, but the results would look nicer, right, more presentable, like having smooth graphs, you know.
Because one so smooth. Can't but think there's a bit of data errors.
That could be, yeah, that could also be data, because after all, the data we have, as I said, is quite limited, short, volatile. I'm not even sure who are the contributors, because you know this year contributor A, B, C. Next year it could be D, E, F. So, but they give us the data and we just try our best to model it. But volatility. But yeah, you agree. When we take these results, we have to keep in mind the data itself. It has a lot of variability in the data itself. So it could turn out to be better than the numbers that is shown.
So for those with experience in UK data, is it any better than ours? Michael?
Yeah, I think they... it's now a few years since I looked at some UK data, but I mean, found that generally when you're cleaning up the data for a bulk annuity transaction, you find a few people who are no longer of this world and the administrators haven't noticed yet. Oh. So you are going to have some discontinuities in data from when exercises get cleaned up. You'd also, I mean, there's all kinds of sort of things that can go wrong. Partly the complexity of the system has outgrown the ability to deal with the complexity, and that does impact on data quality.
Thank you. All right, last chance for anyone. Nothing from the webinar? Not from that. Oh well, Jackie, thank you very much. You obviously are a thorough expert in this area, and you've shown your deep understanding, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.